K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and as I speak, people are all gathering at the casino in near Bismarck on the Turtle Mountain Res, welcoming Leonard Peltier. He arrived home yesterday. It was just an amazing day yesterday, so I thought I'd share some of that. it was just, you know, to see him released from prison, and they had a picture, you know, and he was in this, you know, like tan jumpsuit, and boy, it didn't take long for them to put a beautiful, beautiful ribbon shirt on him and some new shoes and jeans, and wow. But this is from Indians.com, A.C. Agolo, and she says, after spending nearly 50 years behind bars, American Indian Movement activist Leonard Peltier is finally free. Following a grant of executive clemency from former President Joe Biden, Peltier was released from federal prison on Tuesday morning. He is now on his way to North Dakota, to the homelands of his tribe, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians. Quote, today I'm finally free. They may have imprisoned me, but they never took my spirit, Peltier said upon his release from a U.S. government penitentiary in Florida, according to the Indian Collection, a nonprofit that advocated for his freedom. Quote, thank you to all my supporters throughout the world who fought for my freedom. I am finally going home. I look forward to seeing my friends, my family, and my community, he added. It's a good day today. In Florida, Peltier was welcomed by representatives of the Indian Collection. The group is helping him return to Turtle Island, where he will serve out the remainder of his sentence in home confinement. Quote, Leonard Peltier is free, said Indian Collective founder and CEO Nick Tilson. Quote, he never gave up fighting for his freedom, so we never gave up fighting for him. Today, our elder, Leonard Peltier, walks into the open arms of his people. Quote, Peltier's liberation is invaluable in and of itself, yet just as his wrongful incarceration represented the oppression of indigenous peoples everywhere, his release today is a symbol of our collective power and inherent freedom, added Tilson, who is from the Oglala Sioux tribe. Once in North Dakota, Peltier will be seeing more friends and family. Indian Collective is hosting a celebration at the Sky Dancer event on the Turtle Mountain Reservation on Wednesday today to reintroduce him to the community. Quote, there's so much love and intention put into making sure Leonard's welcome home was done in a good way to honor the hard work and prayers of everyone who dreamed of this day and to surround Leonard with the love and gratitude he deserves so that he may find peace and healing from this point on, said Janine Yassi, Indian Collective's Director of Policy and Advocacy. Peltier has been serving two life sentences in connection with the murders of two FBI agents on the Pine Reservation in South Dakota in June of 1975. Activists supported by members of Congress and religious, political, and legal figures worldwide have been seeking his release ever since, arguing that he was prosecuted and punished unfairly during a time of massive change and upheaval in Indian country. And I just want to interject here. You know, yesterday the internet was blowing up. I made sure I got a picture of him when he was released and posted it. And but then I read one post from a young woman. She's a mother of two children. I think her oldest is 10, and I think her daughter just turned 5, maybe. And but she said when she was in 9th grade, she was really, you know, she has Native blood. She's part Dene. And she said, she was really looking into, you know, Native studies. And she wrote an essay about Leonard Peltier when she was in the 9th grade. And when I read that, it just brought me to tears. That's how much he affected people. And I'm sure this young woman is probably in her 30s now. But in 9th grade, she wrote an article and an essay about Leonard Peltier. To continue, When I take a step back, I think of the generations of people who have worked for nearly 50 years to get Leonard home, National Congress of American Indian President Mark Macaro said during his State of the Indian Nations address last week. Quote, Leonard's story includes traumatic reminders of the barriers that Indian country continues to face, he said in Washington, D.C. The barriers include the ongoing impacts of the genocidal Indian boarding school era. Ahead of Biden's historic apology for the U.S. government's role in removing tribal children from their communities, Macaro said he lobbied for Peltier's freedom as he traveled aboard Air Force One with the former president. Quote, Leonard Peltier is a boarding school survivor. They took him away, Macaro told Native News reporters at a press conference following his speech last Monday. Quote, I doubt that the president knows that. So that's what I opened up with, Macaro said of his time with Biden at the Air Force One, flew from Washington, D.C. to the Gila River Indian community in Arizona, where the apology was delivered on October 25th of 2024. And less than 3 months later, and in one of his final actions as president, Biden signed the order granting clemency to Peltier. A copy of the January 19th, 2025 directive was filed in federal court the same day, according to online records. Quote, today is a testament to the many voices who fought tirelessly for Peltier's freedom and justice. Holly Cook Macaro, a citizen of the Red Lake Nation who heads up government affairs for Indian Collective, said on Tuesday after Peltier was released. And this is from Levi Rickett, and Levi Calm Before the Storm Rickett from the Prairie Band of Potawatomi Nation is the founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online. He was awarded the Best Column 2021 Native Media Award for the print online category by the Native American Journalist Association. And I want to share what he has to say. And it was this morning that he put this out. And he said, braving sub-zero temperatures on a late sunny afternoon, family, friends, and fellow tribal citizens lined both sides of Highway 281 at the reservation entrance to welcome home Leonard Peltier on Tuesday. The crowd swelled to over 100 an hour before Peltier arrived in a white Jeep Wagoneer. Some signs read, Welcome home, Grandpa. One read, Welcome back, Ojibwe, an Ojibwe word for warrior. Another read, Welcome home, cuz. And others read, Miigwech, Leonard Peltier, beneath an iconic image of him. 15 minutes before Peltier arrived, a drum group appropriately began performing the American Indian Movement anthem in honor of one of AIM's most iconic members. As the caravan entered the reservation, the SUVs drove slowly through a sea of tribal members who gave Peltier a hero's welcome. The crowd cheered and cars horned echoed throughout the cold air. Peltier waved to both sides on the highway, often with his fist clutched. Peltier, now 80, returned home after 49 years of incarceration, widely regarded as a case of American injustice. For nearly five decades, attorneys and advocates worked to secure his release. Finally, in the final moments of his presidency, President Joe Biden commuted Peltier's sentence. And though it was not the full pardon many had hoped for, Peltier was at least free from prison. Some argue that he is better known globally than he is in the United States. Around the world, Peltier has long been considered a political prisoner. To Native Americans, he has become a symbol of the oppression of indigenous peoples throughout Indian country. Peltier was released from the Federal Correction Complex in Coleman, Florida, and was driven to the Leesburg Airport to be flown to North Dakota. With great AIM warriors such as Dennis Banks, Clyde Belcourt, and Eddie Benton Banai having walked on to join the ancestors, Peltier remains. He will live out his life under home confinement at a home on the reservation. Today, Wednesday, Peltier will be honored at a community gathering at the Sky Dancer Casino and Resort Event Center on the Turtle Mountain Indian Reservation. Welcome home, Leonard. I'm going to share this with you. It's from one of my favorite writers, Simone Moya Smith, from the Lakota Nation. And he's a freelance reporter who has written for Columbia Journalism Review, The Cut, and Lonely Planet, among other outlets, including The Nation. Yes. And he says the Department of Justice recently argued that birthright citizenship does not apply to Native Americans. The administration will likely take aim at Native sovereignty next. And he says, I received a flurry of calls, emails, texts, and direct messages from political junkies when news broke that the Trump administration had called into question the birthright citizenship of us, quote, Indians, or, quote, natives with a capital N, or indigenous with a capital I. We who were here first. Quote, what the hell are they going to, where the hell are they going to send you? A former classmate asked. China? Well, late last month, as part, I don't know if you've heard, but they, you know, when ICE was picking up the immigrants, they picked up some from Pakistan and Afghanistan, and then sent them to Panama. Just thought I'd let you know. Well, late last month, as part of the legal defense of Trump's order to suspend birthright citizenship, the Justice Department cited a 19th century case arguing that, quote, Indians should be excluded from birthright citizenship. And while the 14th Amendment declares that, quote, all people born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, the Justice Department posited that since a law passed 2 years prior explicitly excluded Indians, then so too does the 14th Amendment. In the Justice Department filing, the government lawyers cite the U.S. Citizenship Act of 1866, which states, quote, that all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians, not taxed, are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States. It's imperative to remember how the U.S. government regarded us at that time. The white man called us Indians and savages and was building and forcing indigenous families into a prison camp system, which Adolf Hitler would later praise and discuss with his aides and generals prior to the Holocaust. You've probably heard of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, South Dakota, but you probably only know it by its softer, more palatable name. Its official title is Prison Camp 334. In the filing, Trump's lawyers reference Elk versus Wilkins, an 1884 case in which the Supreme Court ruled that, quote, Indians born on reservations were not automatically U.S. citizens. Yeah. Well, the Justice Department argued then, and by extension argues again now, that because enrolled, quote, Indians of federally recognized tribes owe their primary allegiance to their chiefs, tribal presidents and elders, quote, Indians are not, quote, subject to the jurisdiction of states like South Dakota or Arizona or even the United States itself. The Justice Department wrote in January, quote, this confirms that the children of non-resident aliens lack a constitutional birthright to citizenship. In Elk, the court held that because members of Indian tribes owe, quote, immediate allegiance to their tribes, they are not, quote, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and are not constitutionally entitled to citizenship. This legal gymnastics are dizzying, but we've been here before. The government's use of sophistry and legalese to try to fog the frontal cortex is an all too familiar tactic to indigenous peoples. This is how white men stole billions of acres from our ancestors. They drafted legal documents in that foreign language called English, drowned them in whiskey and gin. Sometimes at the time, our elders had no experience with or understanding of by the fire, and then got them to sign away all their land, water, and almost anything resembling an inalienable human right. But according to today's experts in Indian law, Trump cannot strip natives of our U.S. citizenship because of the, quote, of the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, which officially certified, quote, Indians as U.S. citizens. Quote, what I think Trump is trying to do is Anna Law Guys, explained Steve McSloy, a Columbia law professor who specializes in American Indian law. The Trump team needs to point to historical examples of non-citizens born in the U.S. so that, quote, they're reaching deep into history to find examples of non-citizens when for a long, long time, I don't think those examples existed, certainly not for Native people. He added, quote, they need to figure out who was excluded in the 14th Amendment and try to apply it today. McSloy said that no matter what race you are, if you are a U.S. citizen, you have a right to due process. Quote, if I did bad things, I can go to jail, but you cannot de-citizen me without me being a traitor. There's got to be a whole procedure if you're going to revoke my U.S. citizenship, he said. Quote, that's a fundamental constitutional right that I have no matter what bad thing I did. You could execute me, but I'd still be a citizen on the day you execute me. Trump is unlikely to successfully strip natives of citizenship, but he may take aim at our sovereignty, i.e., our designation as separate sovereign nations. This would allow him to take native lands and sell them to oil and gas conglomerates. This would also nullify treaties between the U.S., between us and the U.S. government. Can he do that, I asked? Always. McSloy responded, quote, at that level, they can do whatever they want. He quoted Justice Stephen Breyer in the U.S. versus Lara when Breyer said that Indian nations are sovereign, quote, it's like a grip. The U.S. can tighten or relax its grip on tribal sovereignty whenever it wants. In 1953, Congress passed the Indian Termination Act, which ended the government-to-government relationship between the U.S. and tribes. It was later overturned at the request of then-President Richard Nixon. That act was intended to assimilate natives into major cities. But should the U.S. Supreme Court allow something similar today, it could strip natives of our sovereignty and then designate tribes and nations, reservations, and Alaska Native villages as counties within its respective state, as the U.S. has before. Quote, the Termination Act said, okay, you used to be the Winnebago tribe, now you're the county of Winnebago, and all the people are citizens of the county of Winnebago, and you better pay your taxes to the state because the trust responsibility is gone. Your treaties are gone, McSploy said. Quote, luckily, that didn't last. If this happens again in 2025, it would make available to Trump millions of acres of indigenous lands held in trust by the federal government. Then Trump, as he puts it, would be free to, quote, drill, baby, drill on those lands. Meanwhile, ICE officials are harassing and rounding up natives throughout the country, particularly in the Southwest. Tribal governments have issued statements preparing their citizens and advising them to carry their tribal identification, specifically their Certificate of Degree of Indian Blood, the CDIB cards. Frighteningly, should the President, Congress, or the Supreme Court repeal the sovereign status of indigenous nations and tribes, the CDIB cards could become null and void. Additionally, monies allocated to tribes for services such as clean water, housing improvement and development, education, and the life-saving Indian Health Service could also end. And they took away the Indian Health Services, but RFK went, whoa, no, 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 no. And he rescinded that and made sure that the workers for the Indian Health Service were rehired or were not laid off. Quote, those patients would completely suffer, said Sarah Bridge, an emergency room physician at the IHS in Gallup, New Mexico. Her patients include citizens of the Navajo Nation and all the nearby pueblos. Quote, there'd be nowhere for them to go. Bridge said Indian Health Services is also a major employer for natives on the nearby reservations, and without her staff, should the funding end, the IHS system would collapse. Quote, if they lose their jobs, they're going to be completely and financially devastated for themselves and their families, and then the hospital won't be able to run. I don't even know how I'd be able to do my job, she said. And I just want to interject here. It doesn't mean that Musk won't try to override RFK. I mean, this morning, he put out, or it was sometime during the night, that he's going to tell Bush that he thinks we should just give every citizen $5,000 so everybody will be happy. But if they were to do that, it would cost, he said, and we'll do it with the money we're saving, you know, by cutting all these jobs. And it would cost close to $1.5 trillion. They've only saved about 40 million. Less than 1% is what they've saved. And I know there's probably a lot of people that might refuse that $5,000, knowing that they're getting it because somebody lost their neighbor, lost their job. One of their family members lost their job because they were working for the U.S. federal government. But to continue. And still, the calls and texts and emails and direct messages from pals and strangers continue. Quote, wait, how is it that people who've been here for thousands of years are now not considered U.S. citizens? A white woman asked me one morning after reading my black You Are on Stolen Land beanie. Quote, our creation stories come from this land. Our languages were invented on this land. White people here can't say the same. So while we predate America, we're still American citizens. Our status as U.S. citizens is unlikely to change, but the Trump administration's thirst for oil and other resources means the U.S. government could try to steal our lands from under us all over again. Simone Moya Smith.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support People Powered Radio at kmud.org.
And this is just a little follow-up piece to the last story. And again, this is from Levi Rickard. And he says, throughout history, the federal government has enacted a range of policies aimed at eradicating American Indian tribes. When extermination proved unachievable, the strategy shifted toward assimilating Native Americans into mainstream society. A key element of this assimilation effort was the establishment of Indian boarding schools, where the guiding principle was to kill the Indian to save the man. Behind every shift in federal Indian policy stood a U.S. president. On this past President's Day, I typically reflect on how past presidents have dealt with tribes. This year is different. I don't have time to look back. I am focused on monitoring the second Trump administration. Since Trump's return to office on January 20th, just 4 weeks ago, it feels much longer. There have been rapid changes. One U.S. senator described the pace as akin to, quote, drinking water from a fire hydrant. For Indian country, these shifts have been especially alarming. One of Trump's first acts in his second term was signing an executive order to rename Denali back to Mount McKinley. Well, last week, Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican of Alaska, chair of the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, introduced legislation to officially recognize North America's highest peak as Denali, the name given by Alaska's Koyukon Athabascans. On Monday, January 27th of 2025, the White House Office of Management and Budget ordered all federal agencies to temporarily suspend grant, loan, and financial assistance programs. The directive included diversity, equity, and inclusion policies and mandated that all federal financial aid distribution cease by 5 p.m. the next day. The memorandum sent shockwaves through Indian country as the federal government is legally obligated to provide funding to tribes. In response, John Echohawk from the Pawnee Nation, founder and executive director of the Native American Rights Fund, NARF, emphasized the government's duty to tribal nations. Quote, because of this unique relationship, the United States must fulfill its trust obligations to protect tribal treaty rights, lands, assets, and resources. Withholding federal funding without consultation is a step in the wrong direction. By Wednesday, January 29th, the executive order was rescinded. Just like, I don't know if you heard in the past week, you know, they fired everybody that was watching all our nuclear arms and being responsible for them. Oh, whoops, didn't mean to do that. Only they got rid of all the files. They don't even have the names and addresses of the people they filed. And they really want those nuclear workers back. Just incredible. And then they got rid of all the people that were monitoring the bird flu that's going across this whole country, and humans are now getting it. Oh, whoops, I guess we shouldn't have done that. Well, I think we better hire them back, too. To continue, despite this reversal, tribal leaders from various national and regional Native American organizations sent a letter to President Trump, members of Congress, and Secretary Doug Burgum, reinforcing that the relationship between tribes and the federal government is based on their status as sovereign political entities, not race. At last week's National Congress of American Indians winter session in Washington, D.C., some tribal officials reported that their finance departments had been unable to access federal portals to withdraw funds. Then on Friday, hundreds of federal employees at the Department of Interior's Bureau of Indian Affairs and Bureau of Indian Education were fired under another presidential memorandum titled, quote, Implementing the President's Department of Government Efficiency Workforce Optimization Initiative. The order targeted federal employees with less than 2 years on the job. You know, and every time I hear that, me, Agnes, goes, wait a minute. Most of those ones that are within the 2 years are college graduates that are trying to pay off their horrendous student loans. And I'm sure some of their pay was being deducted for that. And now they're the ones that are losing their jobs. To continue. And I want to say one more thing, because this has also been, you know, talking about, you know, it's like, well, they're paying, you know, they got rid of all the, you know, safety, FAA safety. And Elon Musk said, you know, well, SpaceX can take care of that. So then they'll get the contract. So all we're doing when we pay our taxes now is giving Elon Musk more money. So why are we paying our taxes? Maybe this year everybody should ask for an extension. People are saying, oh, but, you know, people need their refunds. You really think you're going to get your refunds on time now? They just got rid of like 3,700 IRS workers. So if you think you're getting your money back, it might be a long time. Yeah, everybody, you know, ask for an extension. Why should we keep giving our money to make the richest man in the world richer? I just don't get it. To continue, as a citizen of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation and an American, I experience the duality of my identity, both as a tribal citizen and as an American. This perspective often highlights the irony of history. Today, that irony is unfolding again. It was unacceptable for Europeans to cross open borders to settle in America, yet Trump's MAGA movement insists that borders must be now closed to people with darker skin seeking refuge. This president fuels that narrative with fear-driven rhetoric, demonizing asylum seekers as criminals. It's also concerning that Trump is pushing for control over Canada, the Panama Canal, Greenland, and even Gaza, resurrecting colonial ambitions where none are needed. Since taking office, Trump has directed a private citizen, i.e. Elon Musk, to slash federal spending. However, no safeguards exist in this reckless approach. Cutting costs should come from careful review, not chaos. Senator Brian Schultz, a Democrat of Hawaii, vice president of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, summed it up at an overnight hearing last Wednesday, quote, what's happening right now is unlawful, and it is not our job in a democracy to petition the king for mercy. It is our job in a democracy to stand up and say, this is impermissible under the law. So I remind myself that our ancestors survived President Andrew Indian Killer Jackson. We will survive President Donald Trump too, but we must be warriors in the defense of sovereignty, of tribal sovereignty. I just really felt that that was important for for you to understand what's happening to the indigenous people of this land. And it is chaos. We might all agree, yeah, you know, there needs to be some cutting, some, you know, and we need to, look at things a little more closely. But what is happening to each and every one of us? And on top of that, that hatred that comes out of those MAGA people, wow. And all we can do is share our love, because our love is so much more powerful than that ugly hatred. I want to share a warm story with you. I don't know if this program will happen because, you know, they have help from the Forest Service and the U.S. Forest Service, and so much of that is being cut back. But Herbert Stash didn't set out to start a nonprofit. A handful of years ago, he was just doing what he knew how to do, to take care of his elders. Now Stash is the founder and executive director of the local nonprofit, Warm Elders. The organization operates a wood bank out of Red Mesa in the Navajo Nation. They provide essential firewood to folks who are elderly, disabled, or are veterans. Stash grew up driving 2 to 3 hours up the mountain to harvest firewood with his parents. They would spend most of the day sawing and stacking wood. He learned how to handle a chainsaw and what kind of wood to look for. Quote, every winter it's kind of your role to provide wood for your family, he says. Down home, as far as the culture base is, you always help your elders. It's just one of the things that you are actually taught to do. Stash taught his three sons how to process firewood. The family would deliver wood to Stash's mother on the Navajo Nation. Neighbors in need caught wind of the Stash's role in hauling wood. They requested that the Stashes collect some firewood for their homes as well. A handful of years ago, they were supplying firewood to only a few houses. Now, through Warm Elders, the Stashes are providing firewood to nearly 300 homes. The family-run operation is a small and mighty team, but just one family cannot harvest and process enough timber to support hundreds of homes on their own. 2 years ago, Stash developed a partnership with the Dolores Forest Service District of the San Juan National Forest out of Dolores, Colorado, following the branch's adoption of the Wood for Life program. Wood for Life is a series of partnerships that share the common goal of providing firewood to tribal communities. The firewood is a byproduct of forest restoration efforts funded by the bipartisan infrastructure law passed by the Biden administration in 2021. The restoration efforts support the overall health of the forest. For the Forest Pine Belt, which is managed by the Dolores Ranger District, this means thinning trees. Simply stated, a forest with a diversity of tree sizes can better defend itself against uncharacteristic disturbances such as high intensity wildfires, the beetle kill epidemic, and subsequent gamble oak overgrowth. The biggest trouble with restoration is finding outlets, said Dave Casey, supervisory forester for the Dolores Ranger District of the San Juan National Forest. Ponderosa pine is not a huge valuable resource after it has been cut. Quote, if we didn't have an outlet for the timber, that stuff would either stay standing or it would contribute to having too many trees out there, or it would be pulled and put in a pile and just burn on site. So it's really cool to see it utilized and even further utilized in underserved communities. It's a win-win for the forest and the folks that need wood. The Forest Service handles harvesting the timber through the cut, skid, and deck stages. Quote, this turns the tree essentially into a log, which is then loaded onto a log truck and transported to the wood bank. Last year, Warm Elders received 17 semi-truckloads of timber. Just one semi-truck is approximately 20 cords of firewood, enough to heat 6 homes all winter. Wood is delivered to the wood bank at no cost through grants secured by the Forest Service and the National Forest Foundation, a partner organization that builds bridges between the Forest Service and communities. I just really wonder if that's going to continue on with what's going on in Washington right now. quote, "The great thing about the National Forest Foundation is that's where the Forest Service ends is at the boundary of the forest. And then this partner steps in and makes that connection with the chapter houses or Herbert. It takes that money out to the public. It gets that money from Washington to the folks that need it," Casey explains. "Grants also enable the Forest Service to provide warm elders with updated tools that encourage safer and more efficient wood harvesting. But the grants have not financed the whole effort. Consistent financial support is coming from the family members that operate warm elders, many of whom work full-time jobs here in Moab, Utah. Stash, family members, and volunteers further process and prepare the wood. Work weeks are divided into processing days and distribution days to keep the operation focused and organized. Folks receiving firewood are encouraged to pick up their allotment from the wood bank, but some people do not have a means to get to Red Mesa or the ability to load and unload the wood themselves. Warm Elders has been known to deliver firewood to folks in need over 2 hours away from their wood site. In 2023, the program ran out of wood before the winter's end. Given the limited supply of material and additional resources, Warm Elders has adopted an application program to ensure that the folks who are most in need of firewood are receiving assistance. Quote, "The bottom line is we want to target the elderly that really need it," said Therese Stash, the eldest son of Herbert and Charlene Stash. Quote, In a way they feel forgotten until we go out there and help them and talk with them. Some elderly folks live alone, and the Stash family would hear about their dire situations through word of mouth. Quote, "They're burning tires or just whatever they have in their home to stay warm," Therese continues. Quote, "We are glad that we are able to help them out in that way." People can apply for wood allotments for themselves or others on the Warm Elders website. If folks are not elderly, disabled, or not veterans but need firewood to stay warm through the winter, they can trade volunteer time for firewood with Warm Elders. The success of the project also requires the support of volunteers. Folks can assist by chopping, stacking, and loading logs. Anyone interested in operating machinery will receive training to do so safely. Stash says that part of his vision was to target individuals that have equipment such as a chainsaw or an axe at home. They can learn how to use their personal equipment and return home with these developed skills. If people are interested in volunteering with wood processing who do not have their own personal protective equipment, Warm Elders has glasses, gloves, chaps, and earplugs. They just have to come with their boots on, Stash says. Manual labor is only a part of the effort and is not required to lend a helping hand. Volunteers can prepare meals to support the other volunteers at the wood site. They can assist with fundraising, advertisement, or other forms of outreach. And I just felt that was a very beautiful, warm story to share, that knowing the elders. I've been out there, and I know how far away they are. And you know, they depend on their nephews and sons and other family members to help them with the firewood. So Warm Elders is a really wonderful thing, an organization that they started. And that's what it's all about right now, helping each other in any way we can. I know some people, you know, go, "Oh my God," but, you know, turn off the news. Go outside and stand in the rain. Enjoy the beauty that Mother Earth has given us. And as much as white man destroys her, she can survive without us, but we cannot survive with Mother Earth. We're living on stolen land that was built by people who were stolen from their land. We are all children of Mother Earth, and we all have a responsibility to take care of her. So do what you can. Ask that older neighbor if they need some help. Because when you give of yourself, you get so much more back. I'm going to close with Ramita Kohli, and this is her version of God Bless America. And I just want to translate some of her words. We go forth in sadness, all of us. We stand side by side. We will walk together. We shall make it through all of adversity. And I'll be back.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.